Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to the Federalist Society's special Talks with Authors, What Are the Extent and Limits of Executive Power? I'm Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. I'm very pleased to welcome three guests. I think all of them are return guests at Federalist Society events, of course, and three authors. We're joined first by Professor Michael McConnell. He has a new book out titled The President Who Would Not Be King, Executive Power Under the Constitution, just out recently. We also have joining us Professor John Yoo. He's the author of Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, and Professor Sai Prakash, his book titled The Living Presidency. I have them all. I've looked at them all. I haven't read them all, but I recommend them all. We're going to get opening remarks from each of our authors, probably 5 to 8 minutes. We're going to highlight Professor McConnell's book in particular, and then we'll get reactions from Professor Prakash and Professor Yoo. Very pleased to have all of you with us today. For a note for the audience, this is being recorded and will likely be posted on our website as a podcast of one sort or another, maybe even transcribed. And as always, the comments remain those of the author, the experts, and not the Federalist Society. But with that, Professor McConnell, what did you have in mind when you were putting pen to paper? And tell us about your book, the thesis, and its various claims.
Well, thanks very much, Dean, and thanks for having me. And my, what could be better than a recommendation for the book by somebody who admits that he hasn't read it? I trust the audience will take that recommendation for even more than it's worth, right? So I'm particularly pleased to be here with John and Sai, and I think this is going to be a fun conversation for the following combination of reasons. One is that I think the three of us, by and large, share similar, if not identical, interpretive methods, and we're all serious about the way in which text and history bears upon modern questions of constitutional law, but that we, I think, come at the presidency from somewhat different directions. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sai and John, but you know, I think of the three of us, I'm probably the most Whiggish of the three, which is I am not a fan of an overbearingly powerful executive, and I think that Congress was intended to be the primary organ of policymaking in our republic. I don't go as far as many scholars do when the presidency is in the hands of the opposite party, but nonetheless, and I think if I can, maybe I shouldn't characterize the other two, but I think that, you know, Sai and John both believe that the presidency at the beginning, as it was understood, was more powerful than that. But Sai comes a little closer to me in thinking that a modern presidency has really gone off the rails. But I guess my only real modern comment is going to be that what really matters is that we understand the presidency in consistent ways, regardless of what party holds office, regardless of whether we like the president or dislike the president. And Dean, you asked me about why I wrote this book, but I started writing this book back, about 5 years ago, when I, along with almost everybody else, assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to be elected president. And we had just come off of 8 years of a pretty aggressive presidency in which the executive branch was aggrandizing. Remember President Obama's his pen and the phone. So, you know, he had gotten frustrated with the fact that the Congress of the United States often disagreed with him and therefore was increasingly charging off in a unilateralist direction, of course, with his cheering squad and the media and the academia and most of the other pinnacles of cultural authority. And it seemed to me that as I was writing this book, I was expecting that Hillary Clinton would just be a somewhat less effective and less charming version of more of the same. And then when, you know, the surprising Donald Trump becomes president, I find that that what I had to say about the presidency continued to hold water, and now that, you know, the tide has turned again, and already we see the Biden administration taking liberties with its statutory authority and what really amazes me, maybe that's not true, it just confirms my cynicism, is that most of the folks who thought it was a terrible thing for President Trump to use the powers of the office as creatively as he sometimes did tend to be much more enthusiastic about it now. Just a few words about the construct of the book, which is that I have put together an explanation for how the presidency, how Article II was put together. And I think it has important bearings on current interpretation. But most of the book is not about current law, almost very, very only a few illustrative examples at the end. I think Article II is very difficult to understand, and that you really have to peel back some of the mysteries of the Constitutional Convention in order to understand how it was put together. Part of this is because the principal authors of Article II and of the presidency, therefore, were actually committees that met behind the scenes, where we do not have the direct records, that relatively little of the important work was done by the convention in open debate. When the Virginia Plan was presented to the convention, it had an extraordinarily powerful executive with the prerogative powers of the royal monarch, causing young Charles Pinckney to sputter and say, "Oh no, how can this will create a king? This will just make us an elective monarchy." And the convention seemed to agree with him, and he was particularly worried about the unilateral power of the executive in what he called peace and war, what we would call foreign affairs and military affairs. And but there were a couple of speeches by important framers, James Wilson, John Rutledge in particular, in which they had a somewhat more, obviously had a more nuanced understanding of both royal prerogative and what they wanted to see from the new president. Well, the convention voted to create a unitary executive, but with very little power. And that's the way it sat for a month and a half until the Committee of Detail, the most misnamed entity in the entire framing period. The Committee of Detail is actually responsible for most of the details of most of the structure of our federalism, as well as our executive branch. And chaired by none other than Rutledge, with James Wilson right there, and they completely scrapped what had been done at the beginning and created a presidency with limited but nonetheless much more significant power. My theory, and then I'm going to subside. My theory is that they used Blackstone's account of the royal prerogatives of the king, but instead of giving them all to the executive, as the Virginia plan appeared to do, they divvied them up between Congress and the president, giving quite a few very important powers to Congress. I mean, the power to declare war is one that John and I knew exactly what that meant. We may disagree about, but it was a royal prerogative of considerable importance that was not given to the president. And in fact, by one count, about 13 of the 27 enumerated powers of Congress were in fact royal prerogative powers, that is to say, executive powers under the British Constitution. Others of the royal prerogatives were denied to the new federal government altogether. For example, the control over the national church and the power to create titles of nobility and so forth. And then finally, a number of the powers were given to the executive down. And so, and then in the end, they also created a kind of a catch-all category with the first sentence of Article 2. So they allocated implicitly or either implicitly or explicitly all but one, as I count them, of Blackstone's prerogative powers of the king. They allocate them all, with leaving one out. The removal power is not, I think, explicitly allocated. And then they feel safe in giving the residue of the executive power to the presidency, but those powers being subordinate to the enumerated powers of Congress, where they might come into to clash. And that, to my mind, then creates the structure of the executive, which I think I've used up more than my fair share of time. So I'm just going to say that it bears almost no resemblance to the powers controversy that everyone learns in first year of law school, coming from Justice Jackson's concurring opinion in Youngstown Sheet and Tube, the steel seizure case. So I think that the Supreme Court has begun, basically has created a framework that bears no resemblance to the actual Constitution and has ignored the structure that the framers had envisioned. So thank you.
Thank you. Professor Prakash?
Well, it's great to be here with Professor McConnell and Professor Yu, and thanks, Dean, and the Federal Society for having us today. And I agree with so much of what Professor McConnell just said. His book is wonderful. You know, on the question of the topic for the panel, you know, what is the extent of executive power? And of course, that phrase can mean different things over different time. It meant different things in different times in England and then Great Britain and the United Kingdom. But in the 18th century, I think the executive power was principally about law execution. That's the sort of action that gives the executive power its name. And so, the crown and state governors and colonial governors and our president is principally a law enforcement officer. A lot of people talk about the attorney general being the chief law enforcement officer, but it's actually the president. As Hamilton put it, the president is the constitutional executor of the laws, ex officio. He doesn't need some statute to indicate his role in that regard. And then, as John and Michael have written, and as I've written as well, the executive power also had a foreign affairs component, what Locke called a federative power, but at times also called an executive power by Montesquieu's time. It's clearly understood to be an executive power. The executive power over foreign affairs. It's understood as an executive power prior to the Constitution under the Articles of Confederation. Continental Congress was primarily an executive and not a legislative body. Most of its powers were related to foreign affairs and supervision of bureaucracy, and those were executive powers. And lots of people called the Continental Congress an executive it sounds strange to our ears, but you know, there's nothing about a Congress that necessarily makes it legislative. It's just a meeting of people. It's the powers that give the sense that it's a legislative body today, not the name. And then a third aspect is the control of the military, which is, of course, related to foreign affairs, but not entirely covered by it, right? Because it covers domestic affairs, use of the military in law execution, use of the military to suppress rebellions. And then finally, the last sort of understanding of executive power is related to the first three, and it's control of the bureaucracy, its appointment and removal, its direction of the bureaucracy. And I think, you know, as Michael discusses and John knows, and I've discussed elsewhere in a book called Imperial from the Beginning, these four senses of the executive power are amply reflected in early history, but they're also amply reflected in prehistory, right? If you look at the state constitutions, they all have grants of executive power. Many of them, most of them have grants of executive power. And they're clearly not a reference to the particular powers vested in the governor or the plural executive. How do we know that? Because sometimes these state constitutions only mention one or two powers that are going to go to the executive, and then actually have a catch-all which says, and they have other executive powers. Well, that's the sort of structure of Article II, except the other executive power stuff is in the vesting clause, right? It says the executive power shall be vested in the president. And then it lists a bunch of other powers that are, in a sense, constraints on the otherwise more fulsome grant of executive power. So the president can't make treaties without the Senate's consent. The president can't appoint without the Senate's consent. And so the natural reading of the vesting clause is where there's an executive power not limited by the rest of the Constitution, either in Article 2 or in Article 1, it rests with the president alone, right? That was the position that Hamilton and Madison took with respect to removal. But where it is limited by the rest of the Constitution, either the president can exercise it or has to exercise it as specified in the Constitution. The president cannot regulate foreign commerce because that is given to Congress, and it's understood that the president no longer has it by virtue of the vesting clause. The president cannot declare war. Whatever that is, we all agree that the president can't do it. We disagree as to what it means to declare war, but we all understand that whatever it is, the president can't do it. And then I mentioned earlier treaties, right, and how the president can't make them without the Senate's consent. I'll end by agreeing with Michael that the modern president, modern presidency has sort of slipped the bonds of the Constitution with respect to a couple of things. Presidents are now lawmakers. They were just a part of the process in Article 1, Section 7, but now they are, lawmakers in the fullest sense because Congress has delegated authority. But also, as Michael mentioned, presidents adopt increasingly aggressive readings of statutes that aren't tethered to the statutory text to advance their policy goals. And in so doing, they're basically creating law out of thin air, right? Presto, changeo. With respect to foreign affairs, there's all kinds of changes, but the most significant one is that presidents no longer feel like they have to submit treaties to the Senate for a two-thirds vote. They use something called the Congressional Executive Agreement. They just get Congress to pass a bill, and they use the bill as a basis for ratifying an international treaty. That's NAFTA, right? There are many trade agreements that are done that way that would have in the past had to go through the Senate. That's an evasion of the two-thirds requirement. Maybe it's a good invasion, but it is an evasion of that requirement. And then finally, John and I disagree about this, but the founders, I believe, to a person, thought that the president could not wage war because to wage war was to declare it. And as John, Michael, and listeners know, presidents today, of course, do wage war on their own authority. The most recent large-scale example of this was Libya, where President Obama took us to war for months in Libya without congressional authorization. I will end there, and I look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Professor Yu?
Well, thanks, Dean, for calling us together, and thanks to Mike and Cy for their books. And so I was trying to figure out what to say to disagree with my two friends and colleagues. So I thought maybe what I'd do is very briefly maybe place this book in the setting of where we are with scholarship these days. So we're coming up on the, believe it or not, this is going to make us all feel old. We're coming up on the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Federal Society next year. I can't believe that. So four decades of the Federal Society. And so when you go back and look at the early conventions and the topics and the speakers, even from 1982, one of the most interesting topics to people in the Federalist Society was the exact question we're talking about here. You know, how far did the president's powers go? And so I hope that at the end of those four decades, these three books are not sort of the end point of the Federalist Society's interest in examination. Or maybe this is like the, you know, the Summa Theologica. This is the finest expression of all that has come before. And why would anyone need to improve on it after this? But you see in these three books are the, I think, the summation of all those four decades of thinking and wrestling with executive power. And it also comes at a time that's interesting in the scholarship because for those who aren't reading the Law Review articles carefully, there is a sort of resurgence of this idea from some scholars who think that the executive power in the vesting clause means basically nothing, that it's a ceremonial. And there's been a number of high profile Law Review articles published over the last two or three years that make the claim that all the executive power is only the power to execute the laws and that anything else is sort of a modern invention. And so one thing I think that's interesting is that the three of us looking at the same evidence and share the same originalist methodology come, I think, quite clearly to the view that this was not the original understanding of the Constitution, that the founders did think there was something in the vesting clause, that it's a kind of the structural version of the Ninth Amendment, that it brings in some kind of unenumerated powers that are not within the text. And I would say this always has caused problems for originalists, for Federal Society devotees, because many of them don't think there should be any part of the Constitution that has this living, breathing quality to it. You remember Judge Robert Bork, one of the heroes at the beginning of the Federal Society, he famously said that the Ninth Amendment should be treated like an ink blot. He also wrote an article that did make the claim for what I'd say unenumerated powers within the vesting clause, but it was, for him, it was interesting. It was stridently non-originalist. He made, for example, he wrote an interesting article about the president's war power, and he made the claim for basically on practicality. I mean, there's in the modern world with nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles, it was impossible to have leadership from a body of 535 people. And so it's interesting, many of the people who were one that they're at the founding, they're at the, you know, the president at the creation, I think felt some kind of a disjunction between their commitment to originalist methodology, but then their support of a vigorous presidency of the Reagan years, particularly, but the Reagan-Bush years. And you could say all three of these books are an effort to come to grips with that because they all try to studiously use originalist methodology to address these questions and not to make their claims based on modern practicalities and still find some kind of area where the executive has some freedom or there's some powers that are not strictly defined in the text. And of course that, you know, brings us on how to think of the Biden administration, how to think about the Trump years. So the thing I think that's different from my two friends books is that I think I place probably more emphasis on the political theory of the time to try to define what executive power means. I would say if there was a difference, I think Mike's is an effort to look at how did the phrase evolve through the almost like the legislative process of the Constitutional Convention. And I think his is the most careful. I think in my review for the Federalist Review, I said, this will replace Thatch's book. If you did work in this field, you would read Thatch's book, which was written in the 20s about the Constitutional Convention and how the executive power changed. And so I think Mike's book, his difference from the other pieces of work is that he really almost day by day goes through the Constitutional Convention in a more careful way than anybody had ever before. I think where Cy and I differ is that Cy, I think, and I quite agree with this, the way he generally approaches questions, but I think that where we differ is that he places more emphasis when you try to understand original public meaning on what the words sort of commonly meant at the time. So when we talk about declare war, Cy's work has said, what does, declare war mean to the people at the time? he looks at everything, like letters, speeches, and so on. And my difference is probably that I tend to think of the words in the Constitution more legalistically or as a matter of what they would have meant to political theorists at the time. So I might care a little bit more, for example, what Machiavelli thought the word executive meant than perhaps what, I don't know, what diplomats of the time might have thought, or when it comes to declare war, for example. I think that's where Cy and I differ. And I think that's where the three books read together give you these different, really more emphasis on what we all consider to be the most valid data or history to look at. And just lastly, what does this mean for questions of today? One thing I think that's interesting about President Biden is that it would seem to me the founders thought that the biggest scope for an unenumerated executive power would be in foreign affairs and national security. And you might have seen just recently that President Biden called for the repeal of the authorization to use military force. Maybe I'm wrong, but I can't think of another president who has wanted before to narrow and limit his own powers in national security in this way. Maybe except for President Carter would be an example. But even President Carter did things like the Iranian hostages operation. I don't think President Carter did not actually acknowledge the constitutionality of the War Powers Resolution. I think President Biden, it'd be interesting, I think he may well think the War Powers Resolution is constitutional. It'll be interesting to see whether he obeys it over the next 4 years. But this is not, this is, I think, what the unusual thing is. I think I agree with what Mike said. You're probably going to see President Biden expand his efforts to use executive power when it comes to domestic affairs. He's using executive orders and interpretation of regulations just as vigorously as Trump did. Just the political polarity is in a different direction. But the claims of power, I think, are very similar. But it's in foreign affairs and national security, I think, where you could see this real difference, this effort to try to actually narrow and reverse what had not just been the practice of the Trump administration, but many previous presidents back through till FDR at the very least, in an area where I think we all agree that the founders thought that the Constitution in the vesting clause acknowledges a sort of broader presidential power than just what's strictly set out in Article 2. So thanks very much for bringing us together, Dean. I look forward to comments and questions.
Great. The questions are piling up in the chat. Professor McConnell, I want to give you a chance to respond and augment before I ask a question or two or turn to the audience. But again, for the audience, the title of the book we're talking most about today by Professor McConnell, The President Who Would Not Be King. Professor McConnell.
I certainly don't need any rebuttal time. I appreciate the thoughtful comments that John and Cy have made on the book. I wonder if we disagree on this, and let me just throw this to John. One of the most important foreign policy questions today is whether the Biden administration will be able to stitch together the joint plan of action, what we usually call the Iranian nuclear agreement. And the way I look at this is that Congress had passed a series of statutes imposing sanctions on Iran, giving the president two different kinds of waiver authority, a very broad waiver authority, but hinged on certain findings of Iran sort of standing down with respect to international terrorism and aggression, where President Obama did not invoke that broad waiver authority. And I assume that's because even they were not willing to make the preposterous claim that Iran had actually satisfied those preconditions. And then Congress also gave the president in each of the statutes very narrow waiver authority. So for very specific waivers of sanctions for short periods of time. And the way I see this is that the president stitched together all these tiny waivers and made them into a big waiver, even though the Congress had not authorized a big waiver without certain findings. Now, that leads me to conclude that the agreement was beyond presidential authority, but that might be because I'm not sure. I'm curious whether John believes that the unenumerated foreign affairs power of the president is sufficient to permit him to enter into an agreement like that in the face of congressional statutes within the enumerated powers of Congress.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So the one thing, in addition to these sanctions statutes, that I actually think might have been a mistake for the Congress back at the time of the original JCPOA to have made was, you might remember they passed actually a statute for the approval or not of the JCPOA, but they did it in this very strange way where they said they created a mechanism, a requirement that there be a vote to disapprove the JCPOA, not to approve it, to disapprove it. And then, but then the Democrats filibustered a vote on the bill. It's called for in the bill. And so if you were to look at this from the Youngstown framework, right, you would have on the books, there's a statute that says, you know, unless, you know, Congress shall have the right to vote against the JCPOA and then the vote fails. And so before we get to the sanctions statute, it seems to me, if you think Youngstown is the proper framework, I'm not sure it is, but if you think it is, then that sounds like you've gotten into Youngstown category two, if not category one. And then, you know, there's this broader statute specifically written about the JCPOA, which the president has survived. The interesting thing is, I think that I was trying to look this up a few weeks ago, whether if President Biden re-enters the JCPOA, he has to resubmit it to Congress and it would go under this mandatory vote statute again. I think that's an interesting question. But then it seems to me that statute constitutionally more precedence than the, you know, the individual sanctions bills. You know, some of them are just under IEPA and are sort of general statute bills with presidential waivers, don't even have to do with Iran specifically. And then I think there's just this a separate interesting question. How far can the president go in an international agreement on his own with another country, just promising how to use his essentially authorities under domestic law? It seems to me that if it's not sort of legally enforceable, then the main check is just the next president reversing it. So I don't know why it would be unconstitutional for a president to promise, say, the head of another country to say, if you do this, then I promise I'm not going to invoke the sanctions power that Congress has given me, but which I have discretion over. I confess, I think the Constitution is not clear on what the difference between a treaty that has to go to the Senate is and what's a sole executive agreement that the president can make, given that presidents have made sole executive agreements from the beginning. Not defer to Cy now.
Cy, do you want to weigh in here? Or
this is a really confusing area because the JCPOA was not meant to be an executive agreement. It was meant to be a political commitment. And so the Constitution, you know, has this treaty clause, but it also mentions things called compacts. And as John mentioned, presidents have long made agreements with foreign nations, but not submitted to the Senate when they're sort of unimportant. And then there's this third category of just commitments that aren't agreements. And the JCPOA was expressly designed not to be an agreement and not to be a treaty. And then to make it even more confusing, the act that John mentioned talks about submitting an agreement to the Senate, but the Obama administration consistently said, this is not an agreement. This is a political commitment. So technically, I don't think they had to get the Senate's approval or even had to go through that process. So they sort of papered a document that didn't create any legal obligations, but everybody talked about it as if it were an agreement, right? It's called the Iranian deal. It's called the Iranian agreement. And when we left, people said, we broke our word. We broke our promise. And so even the people, you know, who are deep in this field, the international lawyers, are confused about what the JCPOA is. Is it an agreement? Is it a binding agreement on the international level? Or is it just, you know, plans of action, as the document seems to suggest? And I think it's deeply confusing for anybody in the field, let alone people not in the field.
Okay, just throwing one other point on size point is, I don't think it should matter what international lawyers call it. So whether they, what the, you know, whatever the heading of the agreement is, it seems to me the Constitution requires us, you know, under domestic constitutional law, to look at it and make a judgment about whether it's a treaty that requires Senate consent, a congressional executive agreement, sole exec. And it seems to me calling something a political commitment is an agreement. That's right. It's just sort of when it crosses from political to legal. So to give an example, you know, famously at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy basically said to the Russians, Soviets, if you remove your missiles from Cuba, allegedly there were two promises made. We will remove missiles from Turkey. Maybe we should have kept them there to keep an eye on the Turks now that I think about it. But right, we remove missiles from Turkey. And then there's a secret promise that allegedly we promised never to conduct a ground invasion of Cuba. Right? None of them are ever reduced to writing, apparently. They're just made. To me, that's not an agreement, right? That seems to me your political commitment that Cy's talking about. It's sort of vague. It's not legal. I agree that JCPOA is a written document with all kinds of provisions and quid pro quos that involve, as Mike says, the exercise of presence, domestic legal. That to me seems like, you know, something that we would call an agreement that has to, under constitutional law, that might have to go undergo some kind of approval or not. But it doesn't seem to me just politics. Maybe that's how you draw the difference. I don't know.
Let me ask a question that might be somewhat related. And we've, at least I've noticed a lot of discussion recently about norms and traditions. You, the three of you take an originalist approach. How much should we be considering the norms and traditions of the exercise of executive power versus the constraints or the powers granted in the Constitution? Is that important? And here I'm thinking, in particular, we've heard this with regard to President Biden. Well, President Trump's abandonment of norms and traditions, but then President Biden, his claims are that he would hew more closely to norms and traditions. But then we see criticism of him for firing the NLRB GC and the EEOC GC and ACUS folks. What do we do about norms and traditions? Are they important or not?
Well, I can say for me, I do think that they are important, but they don't. But they are important as supplements to the Constitution. They help flesh out a political and constitutional practice that within the boundaries set by the Constitution. And they are not, I mean, they're called norms. They're norms because they're not legally binding. But I think that they are, that they should have great force and should be departed from only for very good reason. And I think I'm less worried about this in the foreign policy arena, where breaking of norms is practically a norm going back hundreds of years, then I'm more worried about this in terms of domestic practice. For example, just to use a Trump example, that I think that his interference with the, or attempted interference, I think most of it was just feckless attempts on his part, but his attempted interference with the process of criminal investigation and prosecution strikes me as a violation of a norm that was very important for the country. We didn't like it when the IRS was politicized, and we shouldn't like it when DOJ is politicized either.
I agree with that. I think that maybe I might be more forgiving to the presidency on where those bounds are, because I think that in many of these areas, the founders did not have a strict bright line in mind when they created the presidency, or even used the phrase executive power, because part of the idea of the executive power was that it was supposed to respond primarily to unforeseen circumstances and events before the other branches. And so sort of a periodic repetition of those can create the custom or norm by itself. But in the case of things, Mike's example of President Trump and his treatment of of Bob Mueller and the special counsel, it seems to me constitutionally Trump could have fired it. I don't think any of us disagree with this. I think it would have been no breaking of the Constitution for President Trump to fire Mueller or to order Mueller exactly how to conduct his investigation because of this vision of the presidency as the executive branch in Article 2 being governed ultimately in law execution by the president, backed up by the removal power. But I also agree, I think Sinai wrote a piece about this in the paper, that this would have been a terrible, terrible idea. And that would have broken norms going well before the Ethics in Government Act, the special use of special counsels and the Teapot Dome scandal, and even before. But then the only solution, it seems to me, is to look at the tit for tat powers that the different branches can wage against each other. So I still think that Congress could have impeached the president if it wanted to for firing Mueller or telling Mueller, don't investigate me if it wanted to, because the impeachment clause is it's not just limited to crimes. It's not just a legal standard. It also encompasses political acts.
If I can just weigh in real quick, the president clearly has constitutional power to direct the Department of Justice. Early presidents directed U.S. attorneys and the attorney general all the time, telling them to prosecute people, telling them to stop prosecuting people, and doing so without issuing a pardon, just saying this prosecution needs to stop. And so, John's written about this with respect to the Burr prosecution. Thomas Jefferson is intimately involved. But that, it preceded that. George Washington issued directions. John Adams did as well. Having said all that, it's probably not a good idea for presidents to get involved in every prosecutorial decision, because they don't have the expertise and they don't have the knowledge that people on the ground do. So it's a good norm to have. Can I think of reasons why you'd want to intervene? Of course. If Bob Mueller is investigating the president 4 years later, I think it's crazy. I mean, I think the whole investigation for obstruction was misbegotten. I don't think it should have ever begun. I think it's silly to think that, and supervising the special prosecutors itself, an act of obstruction, because it influences the investigation. If Bob Mueller is still investigating this 4 years later, I think it's entirely appropriate for a president to consider and possibly violate the norm of non-involvement in the Department of Justice.
You don't think it's a particularly bad idea? I know people are proposing it these days, is to make the FBI director or the attorney general protected from removal except for cause. I mean, this has been kicked around since the Watergate days. And on the other side, where you could say, well, politically, some presidents like Clinton or Trump, even, it's in their political interest to have some independence in a prosecutor or counsel. But, and this goes back to my point, maybe the differences between our three books, I think that would really undermine the whole idea of what an executive is. If the idea of an executive is, Machiavelli's point is someone who can act at a stroke, who can act immediately with, the words that are in, Hamilton's contributions to the Federalist Papers. The idea then that you would take the core of the executive power, which is law execution, and insulate it from presidential control, it almost would destroy, I personally would think it would defeat the president. The point of the presidency here is animating force, just as if I think there's a threat to the idea of the independent judiciary. If Congress were just to say, we're going to take most of the cases and move them to Article I tribunals, right? That's the other, last point, is that the parallel arguments we're making about Article II could apply to the judiciary too. And I think it also suffers from the same potential vulnerabilities once you cleave off parts of its duties and protect the people who are going to be in charge of it from presidential control or the Supreme Court's control when it comes to adjudication.
I want to turn to audience questions, but I want to hear from Professor McConnell whether you agree or disagree, in particular with the criminal law aspects, supervision of criminal law, Professor.
Some of these norms and constraints actually empower the executive. One of the most important things about our nation's respect for the rule of law is that people have had confidence that the law is going to be executed in an impartial manner, where whether you're a friend of the president or an enemy of the president doesn't affect the way whether you're going to be investigated or not. I think that's that's part of being a free society. And I think when the president
And I don't mean any one president, the presidency, presidents over the decades have created mechanisms to insulate criminal prosecutions from political interference from the White House, that has made our criminal justice system stronger, more trusted, more reliable. I think that when that is undermined, that it actually weakens the execution of the law rather than strengthening it.
Let's turn now to the audience. I'm in the Q&A here. I don't know if you guys can see these questions or not, but from David Forte, how do you gauge the court's recent interventions to limit presidential power? There seems to be an upward graph of presidential losses running from Clinton through Obama through Trump and now Biden. Professor McConnell, you want to take a shot at that?
I see what David is saying, and I think that that's empirically true, but I don't really think that this reflects a change in the court so much as it is that presidents and recent administrations, both parties, have taken an increasingly imaginative approach to interpreting statutes. And I think that this is, and the courts respond by saying, no, actually you can't, the statute doesn't mean that. You can't do that. Most of the interesting separation of powers questions these days are not presented as constitutional questions, although I think the Constitution is right behind the question. But they are presented as a statutory question. So just, a couple of days ago, a court held that the executive branch has not been given the power simply to cease leasing, entering into oil and gas leases. Well, that's a question. You want to look at the statute. What does the statute say? I thought it was quite hilarious that I read the New York Times article on this with some interest, and it couldn't figure out what the statute said. The New York Times seems to think that the very thing that matters is irrelevant. It's all just, push and shove.
Let me say this is not the first time this experience has happened to you, Mike.
Yeah, well, I get it. I get some amusement out of it anyway, but I think that's the problem. Now, there is a feature in our Constitution that creates this tension between the courts and the president. And I don't think our founders intended this, but I think they created a structure in which this is inevitable, which is that at the end of an average 8-year presidency, which most presidencies have been 8 years in our lifetimes, the president will have named about 40% of the lower federal courts. And then that means that when the presidency changes party hands, that the judiciary, generally speaking, is more in the hands of the opposite party than it is the president's own party. And I think that leads to blowback. And so, Obama experienced this kind of blowback. Trump experienced it in spades because, even the Republican Party wasn't really completely behind him. And now Biden is experiencing much the same thing. And, each party regards this as the judiciary stomping on their toes. But actually, I think this has been a feature of both ways. And is probably, I think we should view it as a feature rather than a bug.
Turning next to a question from
something else that makes me feel bad for presidents of both parties when this happens, because I think if you put it in the context of the administrative state, I think we're arguing, we were talking about before, what's the biggest difference between the modern presidency and the founding? I think it's not really the presidency itself. I think what they would, if you showed them our world today, the thing that would surprise them the most about Article 2 would be the enormous welfare state that's been created. And it seems to me what's been going on is that Congress has just given the executive branch so much responsibility for so many things, big and small. Presidents get elected to office and they become politically responsible for all of it. And so a lot of these exercises of presidential power, while they have a sort of political consequence, I think constitutionally what presidents are doing is just trying to get control over this massive beast of an administrative state. which Congress, for its own reasons, loves to give to the executive branch, blame the president, but doesn't really want the president to have that much control over, because that reduces Congress's control. And so it seems to me every time these losses occur, and I agree, Mike, they've been going on now for several, I think it started with under Clinton, towards the end of the Clinton administration, but then under, you know, started, I think, under George W. Bush. Every time that happens, I think it reduces the ability of the president to control this giant welfare state and makes more and more of it independent, you know, makes more of it approach the kind of, I don't know, Teutonic administrative state that Woodrow Wilson really wanted. I don't think that's, even though the court thinks that when it does this, it's standing up for the separation of powers. I think actually every time it does this, it is actually harming the sort of means of accountability that the original Constitution set up, even for a much bigger state that we have now than we did 220 years ago.
Let me agree with that, and at least in a way. I think possibly the biggest difference between the way we do things today and the founding era is in the administrative state, and it's in the Administrative Procedure Act in particular, because at the beginning, the only mechanism courts had for reining in executive action were the writs of mandamus and prohibition. We all know about mandamus from Marbury versus Madison, but I think many people skip through the important parts of that opinion, which is actually about mandamus and to the question of judicial review of the statute, which I think was actually not as controversial at the time. But the writs of prohibition and mandamus were limited to clear legal violations and not to abuses of discretion. So if the executive was given discretion over a matter, the courts had no say. Well, under the Administrative Procedure Act, you can challenge agency action for being arbitrary and capricious. Well, arbitrary and capricious is a type of review unknown to the founders. And that means that much of the activity of the executive branch is now subject to judicial review in a way that the founders would not have contemplated. That isn't necessary to say that it's unconstitutional, because the Administrative Procedure Act is what it is, and mandamus and prohibition, the definitions are not embedded in the Constitution, but it is a massive change in the way we do things.
Jeffrey Wood's question: for those approaching interpretation from a historical textual perspective, the lodestars seem to be the words themselves, and how the drafting generation understood them manifested in their apparent interpretation. Is there a tension between apparent broad grants of some powers under Article II and the narrow exercise of many of those powers by the earliest presidents, including Madison in particular? Has SCOTUS created parts of this problem by expanding certain doctrine, example, incorporation of certain provisions of the Bill of Rights against the states through the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause?
Well, I'm happy to dump on Madison for a little bit, because I think, like, if you were to say, okay, here's a guy who in the Constitutional Convention initially was in favor of a very broad executive. He did support, you know, some powers of the executive at the beginning, like the removal power. But, you know, famously, after the break between Jefferson and Hamilton, you know, Madison threw in on the Jefferson side. In fact, many people, you know, the scholars of Madison, they kind of think that, you know, after Jefferson returns to America and becomes, you know, leader of the party, that, you know, Madison's importance really falls off, you know, that Madison had this period at the time of the founding. But, you know, as you may know, Madison took the opposite approach to the theory we're laying out about the unenumerated powers of the president. Right? And he just said, for example, the power of war and peace must be legislative. And he said all these arguments about it, some kind of powers in the vesting clause, you know, they sort of reek of monarchy. You know, in the Helvidius specifics, this debates, he sort of reaches his rhetorical heights. Then look what happened when Madison became president and tried to put his lessons to the test. You know, the War of 1812 was a terrible war. The United States is lucky we got out of it with basically a tie. The British came very close to splitting the country in half. Madison left the war up to congressional leadership. I mean, he did. You know, when he was ready, he lived up to what he said in the Helvetius Pacificus debates, and he basically let Congress set war strategy. He let Congress take management of the war into its own hands. And we did disastrous things. First of all, by declaring war on Britain rather than France, you know, declaring war against the only nation that had a land border with armed troops on it. And then the Congress drove us into an invasion of Canada, which failed. And luckily, President Jackson won at the Battle of New Orleans. But I think this is a great example of someone who tries to conduct the executive in the way that many critics of it want. You can see the results in Madison himself. So I'm glad the questioner mentioned Madison, because I think he's a good example of what not to do as president. I think he's one of the worst presidents we ever had.
Professor Brakosch or Professor McConnell?
I'll just chime in. I think I disagree with the premise. Every early president assumed or read the vesting clauses giving them authority over foreign affairs, and they directed diplomats, they controlled negotiations, they controlled correspondence with foreign nations, none of which is specifically mentioned within the Constitution, all of which is derivable from the vesting clause. They also supervise the bureaucracy in ways that are unfathomable today by directing all kinds of lower officers to do certain things and not do other things. And they all issued commissions that said that these people served under their pleasure, and they fired people, right? And so I don't actually think that they had narrow conceptions of executive power, at least as compared to some academic writers of today. Now, did they all have the same theory of executive power? Maybe not at all, you know, maybe not over time. Madison actually believed in the vesting clause thesis, right? He believed in it in the Congress. He even believes it as Helvetius, because if you read it, he says, I think the Congress was right with respect to removal. I just think that doesn't include foreign affairs powers. That's something that he changed his opinion over time, because prior to writing Helvetius, he had said that it did include foreign affairs powers. So I just disagree with the premise of the question. Each of these presidents believed in the vesting clause thesis. Their actions prove as much.
Professor McConnell.
I was going to take issue with the framing of the question too, but from a quite different point of view. The question presupposes that we look at the text in light of the words and how those words were understood. And of course, there's a certain orthodoxy in that. But I think the more important than the words and the dictionaries and the word definitions is the history behind the various provisions, because there's not a provision of the Constitution, certainly not a provision of Article 2, that did not arise out of a particular history, often an unhappy history, sometimes a happy history, but often an unhappy history with the British Crown. And I think the most important thing is to understand where the provisions come from, rather than just to sort of try to parse it as if it's a linguistic exercise.
I make one serious point after going off on Madison, which was not a serious point, but fun. The serious point is, and this is something we may all differ in terms of originalism, is I'm probably more skeptical of using any of the evidence post-ratification. Sometimes it's actually used by people to criticize originalism, right? They'll say, well, if they don't agree, even if the removal power is actually upheld in Congress by the slimmest of margins, and they're all of the founding generation, and they don't agree on it themselves, or they don't agree on whether the president can issue a policy of neutrality in 1793, then how can we 230 years later make any clear judgments about the original understanding? I don't treat disagreement after the founding that way. I think it's just that when it comes to the executive power, it was left somewhat open-ended. So it's not surprising they're arguing over it immediately after, because they're already sort of gripped with the more immediate day-to-day political costs and benefits of a certain position. And so they're not in the status they were before of sort of making a constitution and being maybe more neutral and objective about it. But I also don't think that the practices immediately after ratification should maybe count as much, except, you know, as Mike put it, as you're trying to understand what the words meant because they were part of a right, historical practice of, say, what the executive was, then maybe if you see some evidence afterwards that sort of reinforces what was already understood before. But it seems to me after ratification, that's the politically important event of adoption of the Constitution. And so it seems to me you couldn't have post-legislative enactment, legislative history with a statute. It seems to you constitutionally, you shouldn't really be able to have post-ratification evidence of the Constitution count as part of the original understanding too.
Well, we're out of time, but I know none of you have a real hard stop. I want to give you each a chance to wrap up. Let's go in reverse order than we started. So we'll start with Professor Yu. And as you do that, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about what your theory of executive power says about reversals of positions by a president. And does it matter if the president's reversing himself, if Trump reverses his own position in policy or litigation even, or if a subsequent political opponent reverses a previous president's decision-making?
I'm glad you raised that. This is something I've been thinking about. I've been promising to write an article about this question about the president's power to reverse. And it's actually a good example of the second to previous question about actually several of the questions about judicial expansion of its role, of what, how do we take the differences between now and then. I would have thought, given what the political theory of the day said about the executive power, one of the biggest checks on the presidency is the ability to reverse the acts of past presidents. I think that's more of an important check nowadays when you talk about all the responsibilities the executive branch has, is the ability to reverse the past president. What I think is odd is that there are these growing efforts, somewhat by the Supreme Court, to prevent presidents from having that flexibility and discretion. To sort of require presidential powers to sort of be locked in. And so I've thought the Supreme Court's opinion in the DACA case was extremely puzzling to me, that you could make a decision, that President Obama could make a decision, which was basically an executive order. It was a memorandum on how to use prosecutorial discretion. And then the court said that President Trump couldn't just reverse that in the exact same method used to create it. That, to me, is one of the most important checks on the presidency, and is really part of the nature of the executive, the ability to act, you know, immediately and suddenly with speed. You know, the qualities that Hamilton said are truly executive. So it's just part of domesticating the presidency in this web and network of procedures and reviews and tying down Gulliver, as it were. But I do think that kind of undermines the very purpose of having us an executive branch.
Professor Prakash.
I'll quickly say that I completely agree with Michael's earliest comments about how people's views about presidential power often shift every 4 or 8 years. And I'm proud to say that I think the three people on this panel don't have that view. We don't have the view that presidential power has shrunk now that Biden is president. And it's unfortunate, because what it means is just impossible to have a sense of what the presidency's powers are if your view on that question, that fundamental question, shifts depending upon who's in office. It's just lamentable that this happens. It happens like clockwork, right? Depending on who wins or loses. I'll leave it at that.
Professor McConnell, a final thought.
I agree with John that presidents have the authority to reverse their predecessors, and if a matter is within presidential discretion, that discretion can be exercised in different ways by different presidents. The way you put the question, Dean, made me think you were thinking partly about positions in court, and there I do have a slightly different sense, because I don't actually believe that statutory legal interpretation by the executive should be understood to be a matter of discretion. Of course, different presidents and different administrations sometimes take a different view, but it should. But it strains the theory of what legal interpretation is if they can simply flip on what statutes mean according to what they want them to mean. And in that sense, I think it's been very good that the Biden administration has stuck with some Trump administration positions over vociferous political objection within the Democratic Party. And I think that's a sign that there's a certain integrity in the legal system.
Very good. It sounds like we could explore that further in a future call, perhaps. But my thanks today to Professor McConnell, author of The President Who Would Not Be King, Professor Prakash, author of The Living Presidency, Professor Yu, author of Defender in Chief, all available at Amazon and bookstores everywhere. If you have a bookstore near you, I guess you can go back to bookstores nowadays. But I certainly appreciate your time and your expertise. Thanks to the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. Until our next event, though, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.